This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
What if drought and rainfall changes are not just due to global warming? What if it is industrial pollution? New science examines the role of airborne particles called aerosols as they change weather and lives around the world. Aerosols are tiny bits of matter floating in the air, carried by the wind until they are rained out to drop to the surface again. If you look for a blow-up photo of these specks, they look like tiny asteroids, irregular in shape and often full of holes. That complex surface can be coated with toxic chemicals and even bacteria. There have always been dusty aerosols and even plant scent aerosols on Earth. Your nose and lungs are designed to filter them out and get rid of harmful particles. But industrial processes like diesel engines and power plants create particles smaller than anything in nature. These bypass the human protection system, get through the lungs and into the bloodstream. From there, some even pass through the blood-brain barrier and the placenta, leading to the brain or to fatal damage and disease. This is why millions of people die every year from air pollution. Now we learn aerosols change the climate as well, hiding the real heating and altering rainfall around the world. Welcome to the Breaking Science on Aerosols and Climate Danger. A 2021 study by scientists from Harvard and the UK found at least 8 million people died in 2018 due to emissions from fossil fuels alone. Satellite maps show massive clouds of sulfates remain over China, India, and much of Southeast Asia. China, under pressure from citizens, of course, and sensing mounting health costs, is pushing aggressively to reduce smog, especially in key cities like Beijing and Shanghai. And residents of New Delhi and Mumbai are also calling for the same. What happens to the heat and the rains if they succeed in a cleanup? Aerosols can make changes of historic proportions, sometimes greater than the impacts of greenhouse gases. For example, a study found increasing pollution in Europe during the 1980s led to a major long drought in the Sahel region of Africa. Millions of people died of starvation, unaware that rain for their crops that never came was diverted by a smog further north in Europe. Our first guest led a new study with a whole different view on the world, one we seldom hear about. It is the real role of smog, not just about our health, but about drought, rainfall, and extreme weather. With global record heat this year, plus fires and dangerous floods, climate change and greenhouse gases have the spotlight. But there's another way humans change the air and the weather. Every hour of every day, smokestacks, cars, and homes pump tiny particles into the sky. They are bits of chemicals, metals, plastics, and organic materials, all floating in the air, traveling on the winds until the rain brings them back down. These are the aerosols, and top scientists like James Hansen warns ignoring them is dangerous. We have new science on aerosol pollution. The open access paper is titled, "Rapidly Evolving Aerosol Emissions Are a Dangerous Omission from Near-Term Climate Risk Assessments." Could pollution-driven weather changes be as important for some of you as greenhouse gas emissions? The lead author is Dr. Geeta Persad, Assistant Professor of Climate Science at the University of Texas, Austin. She leads the Persad Aeroclimate Group there. From Austin, Geeta Persad, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you very much for having me.
So a 2021 study by scientists from Harvard in the UK found at least 8 million people died prematurely in 2018 due to emissions from fossil fuels alone. What sort of aerosols come from our heavy car culture and truck transportation?
That's a great point. So many of the same things in our society that produce the greenhouse gases that are bad for climate change also produce these aerosol particles that are really bad for air pollution and for health. So, for example, sometimes you may hear the phrase PM2.5 talked about in terms of air quality, and that means particulate matter that's smaller than 2.5 microns in diameter, so smaller than the size of a human hair. And so those particles can get into our lungs, enter our bloodstream, affect heart health, affect cardiovascular health. And some of the components of that include things like black carbon or soot, which is basically the black stuff that you see coming out of the tailpipe of a vehicle that isn't up to standard. Many of the emissions from wildfire smoke fall into that category. Many of the emissions from industrial activities, so things that produce sulfur dioxide, the production of cement, the production of bricks, this is a big source of these emissions, especially in the developing world. So many of these same activities that we worry about in terms of greenhouse gases are also really problematic in terms of air pollution and aerosols.
So reading your paper, it comes out that the word smog or pollution hides as much as it explains. In reality, there are many, many different kinds of pollution, and these have been changing over time as industry and agriculture have changed. Geeta, can we even compare air pollution, say, in 1970 to what's up there today?
So we actually know a fair amount about how these air pollutants have changed through time. And actually, one of the biggest drivers of the changes in these pollutants has been the desire for better air quality. So we can actually map how the geographic distribution of these pollutants has changed from, say, 1970 to today. And you can actually see the signal, for example, of clean air regulations in the U.S. and in Europe that actually cause a really noticeable reduction in these air pollutants in the mid, 1960s, 1970s, where places like China and India in the period since then have really increased their emissions of these pollutants as they've industrialized. And so we can actually track and map the spatial evolution of these aerosol emissions that has largely come from evolution and trends in air quality regulation, trends in globalization, and trends in industrialization across the world.
Some aerosols cool while others warm. Please explain, is the cooling or the warming dominant?
This is a great question and actually one of the most important, and I would argue as a scientist, interesting things about aerosols. So there are two big differences between how greenhouse gases impact the climate system and how aerosols impact the climate system. The first difference is that greenhouse gases impact the climate system by trapping the heat radiation coming off of Earth's surface, whereas these aerosol particles impact the climate system by interacting with sunlight and also helping with the formation of clouds that interact with sunlight. So when we talk about the types of aerosols that cool the planet, we're talking about the types of aerosol particles that scatter or reflect sunlight. And so you can imagine, even if you pick up a handful of sand on the beach, you might notice that there are some grains that look really white and other grains that look really dark. The same is true of the pollution that ends up in the atmosphere. Some of it is really bright and reflective, and some of it is really dark, which means that it's absorbing sunlight. So when we talk about the types of air pollutants, the types of aerosols that warm the climate system, we're talking about those types of pollution that is dark and eventually absorb sunlight. And so you can get more different types of industrial activity produce more of the scattering types of aerosols, and other types produce more of the warming or absorbing types of aerosols. So, for example, diesel vehicles produce a lot of the warming type of aerosol, which is what we typically refer to as black carbon. Now, when we look at all of the sources of aerosol, of sort of human activities that produce aerosols globally, on average, the cooling component of the aerosols dominates the warming component of the aerosols. But if you look in particular regions, there can actually be a fairly strong balance between the cooling aerosols and the warming aerosols. And that in and of itself can actually have some really important impacts on regional climate that are very distinct from greenhouse gases. Because the other big difference between greenhouse gases and aerosols is that aerosols are very short-lived in the atmosphere. They only last for weeks to months compared to greenhouse gases that can last for hundreds of years. And so what that means is that aerosols don't actually have enough time to get far from where they're emitted. And so as a result, the aerosols actually stay very concentrated near where those pollution sources are. And so some of the climate signals, not all of them, but some of the climate signals from aerosols also stay concentrated near the pollution sources. So the aerosols have a very different sort of geographic fingerprint of climate impact.
Well, a little later, I want to talk to you about some of the possible distant connections, so called teleconnections. But first, I want to get to this. For over a decade, a former NASA scientist, James Hansen, warned there is more global warming in the pipeline. If true, we would get even hotter, even if all the fossil fuel burning stopped today. So Hansen attributed some of the committed warming to the cooling effect of aerosol pollution. Do we know how much heating, how much hotter it would get, maybe even in a percentage of a degree of global mean temperature, if we clean up the air pollution?
So a number that I can give you is if you look over the industrial era and you look at all of the warming that has come from increasing greenhouse gases over the industrial era, the aerosols that have been increasing over that same time period have offset between 30 and 50% of that warming over the entire industrial era. So if you think about the fact that we've warmed about a degree Celsius over the industrial period, if we hadn't had the aerosols increasing over that same period, we might have been 0.3 to a half a degree warmer. And so when we think about things like the really ambitious Paris Agreement target of keeping warming below 1.5 degrees Celsius, the aerosol signal has almost been the difference over the industrial era between whether or not we've already crossed that threshold.
If we just talk about smog and heat, we're missing one of the big stories of climate change. Most of the dialogue about global warming has been about heat rather than extreme rainfall and flood events, which have been striking all over the world this September. Tell us how aerosol pollution can change the way rain falls.
Aerosol pollution can change rainfall through a huge range of pathways. The maybe the easiest one to think about is just in the fact that it's offsetting global warming. And so that's just the very basic idea that we have, that as the global temperatures increase, precipitation may get more intense. And so if you're reducing that global warming, then you're potentially offsetting some of that increase. But the aerosol signal is much more subtle than that. So when we start looking regionally, because aerosols stay have this very patchy spatial distribution, they're also impacting the climate system in a very patchy way spatially. And the big influence that that has is it actually changes regional circulation patterns. And if you think about what actually drives rainfall in some of the most rainfall-sensitive parts of the world, so for example, in South Asia, where huge populations rely on monsoon circulation for food security and for their livelihood. The ability of aerosols to impact the regional circulation in those areas is actually a much more important driver of how rainfall has changed there. So there's actually been a range of studies that show that reductions in monsoon rainfall that we saw over the second half of the 20th century were mostly driven by increases in aerosol pollution both in South Asia, but also across the Northern Hemisphere. And so aerosols can also impact these precipitation patterns through changing these sort of weather patterns that drive rainfall in different parts of the world. And then the third way that aerosols can impact rainfall is actually through the way that they interact with clouds. So we haven't talked very much yet about the fact that these aerosol particles are actually a critical part of why we have clouds on planet Earth. So a cloud is basically just water vapor that's condensed. And in order for that water vapor to condense and form a cloud droplet, you actually need some nucleus for it to condense onto. And these aerosol particles are really efficient nuclei for these cloud droplets. And so what we actually see is that as our atmosphere gets more polluted with aerosol pollution, our clouds can actually get thicker, which means that they have lots of tiny droplets because they have so many of these nuclei available to form cloud droplets on. But what that means is that each of those droplets is really tiny, and what you need for rainfall is a droplet big enough to fall out of your cloud. And so there's an emerging area of research showing that the increase of aerosols in some places can actually suppress rainfall by making it harder for a cloud to rain.
I just want to make this clear. Does the amount of air pollution directly affect weather for people living below it? For example, the air of Mumbai has been clouded with pollution during recent years. If the government acts to clean that up, Would that change weather over Mumbai or over India, or does it change things everywhere?
So I think yes to all of them. So there have been studies that show, for example, that the presence of aerosols in a city can increase the likelihood of thunderstorms. And this gets into really complex processes and how aerosols do things like heat the atmosphere right before a rainstorm. But then you also get these sort of regional circulation effects that I've talked about. You are likely to also get situations where, say, if the air gets cleaned up in Mumbai, not only does that change weather directly over Mumbai, but it's likely to change the overall circulation in that area. And then if you're removing, say, cooling aerosols from Mumbai, you're also removing cooling aerosols from the entire climate system, which means that you are then also theoretically having an influence on the global energy balance that can be felt far afield from just the place where you're removing the aerosol.
This is a climate emergency. Find out more on the blog, ecoshock.org. No sign up, just the latest info, free for all. ecoshock.org.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, Dr. Geeta Prasad from the University of Texas at Austin. We're talking about air pollution, your health, and the weather. Now, when two states seem to occur together in time, even across great distances, science calls that teleconnection. And we may not know the mechanism of how it works, but the recurring pattern is there. So it's hard for us to understand how increasing aerosol pollution in Europe might cause drought in eastern China. Geeta, are we getting closer to knowing how these smog and distant weather connections work?
Yes. There's been a huge body of work over the last 10 to 15 years that have really connected the vast understanding we have of what controls the flow of energy and moisture in the atmosphere with this body of knowledge that we now have about the impact of aerosols on climate. And so there's been a lot of work now that shows that aerosols are capable of basically changing the standard patterns of circulation in the atmosphere, and that's the main pathways through which they create these teleconnections. So I'll give you just one example of that. One of the dominant patterns of atmospheric circulation is what we call the Hadley circulation, which is this pattern of circulation in the world's tropical regions. And this is characterized by lots of rising motion right near the equator, and that leads, for example, to the rainy season across the tropics, and then descending motion over the subtropical regions. And this is actually a big reason why our deserts happen to lie at around the same latitude bands across the world. If you've ever looked at a map, you might notice that, for example, the Sahara Desert is at roughly the same latitude as some of the deserts across North America. And that's not a coincidence. That's actually a result of this atmospheric circulation pattern. Now, one of the things that we know about this Hadley circulation, this tropical rising and subtropical sinking, is that it's very strongly controlled by how much energy each of Earth's hemispheres is getting. And one of the things that aerosols have done over the industrial era is that they've cooled the northern hemisphere more than the southern hemisphere. And that's because most of our industrial activity that's been producing these aerosols has been in the northern hemisphere, places like North America, places like Europe. And so that actually has pulled this tropical circulation pattern off of the equator. And it's that process that we think has led to some of the teleconnected signals that we've seen in response to, say, changes in European emissions. So, for example, during the 1980s, there was a major drought in the Sahel region of Africa that led to massive famine and huge loss of life. And this scientific understanding that has emerged over the last 10 or 15 years has allowed us to connect that reduction in rainfall over the Sahel to the increase in European aerosol emissions and the effect that that had on this tropical circulation pattern that's so important for precipitation in places like the Sahel.
Wow. So a non-industrial region, relatively, like Africa, could have people, they can't get enough rain for their rain-fed agricultural crops, so there's going to be starvation because of pollution, possibly in Europe, or you could have that in other parts of the world where industrial centers are changing things far away.
Yes, this is one of the points that we really try to emphasize in the paper. I think it's really easy for people to think that air pollution is only a problem for the places that are breathing it in. But through these climate pathways, we're really showing that the changes in this aerosol pollution are not only an issue for the places where those changes are happening, they can be a problem basically across the whole world.
In early 2020, ports closed and industrial production was greatly reduced in many countries due to the pandemic. What happened to aerosols then, and did that produce any expected changes?
Yes, so there were a range of studies that emerged after the COVID-19 crisis and all of the shutdowns that happened to try to capture the effect of that reduction in aerosol pollution for overall climate. The reality, though, that signal was pretty small in the grand scheme of things, and then our emissions and our activity picked right back up again. So it's a very short-lived impact on climate. However, it is important to note that aerosols obviously were not the only thing that changed during the COVID pandemic. There were changes in carbon dioxide emissions, changes in even the amount of airplane contrails because there was so much less air travel. And of all of the different changes in sort of our industrial activity that could have influenced climate during COVID, the aerosol signal was the largest. So even though the overall signal of the COVID pandemic on climate was fairly small, the aerosol signal was the most important part of that. And so when we think about maybe more sustained long-term changes in industrial activity that the COVID-19 pandemic might be an analog for, that's really demonstrating that this aerosol signal is a really important marker of industrial change that we know can have an influence on the climate system.
Well, and long-term planners and modelers, they generally work for big universities or institutions or governments. It's expensive stuff. They seldom include the possibility this economy could collapse. I mean, suppose civilization went into a prolonged industrial depression and aerosols drop rapidly, say within a couple of months. What would happen?
So this idea of how sort of the evolution of society is going to impact the evolution of aerosol pollution is a really fascinating area and one that I would argue we really don't understand well. And so if you actually look at the sort of socioeconomic models that are used to build sort of scenarios of how aerosol emissions might evolve, there's actually often an assumption that if societies are doing well, aerosol emissions will actually go down. And the reason for that is that as a country, say, gets richer, it has the ability to put more of its resources into doing things like cleaning up its air. And so it may be more willing to invest in technologies that may be more expensive, but that are cleaner. And so as a result, there's often this assumption that as we get richer, we will reduce our aerosols just because of those air quality benefits. So you could argue, actually, that in the scenario that you painted, where our economy collapses, you might actually see more aerosol emissions because as our economy collapses, rather than eliminating industrial activities altogether, we might shift our mode of industrial activity to get rid of all of the more expensive things that we have done to clean up our air, just so that we can at least produce the things that we need to produce. There's an important open question about how these different trajectories of how different societies are going to evolve is going to affect human emissions of aerosols. And that's actually a big uncertainty. If you look at the uncertainty in how aerosol emissions are going to evolve over the next 30 years, exactly because of this uncertainty in the sort of trajectory of society, they could grow to 20% higher in the next 30 years, or they could fall to nearly zero. And that is coming almost entirely from this uncertainty in what the trajectory of society is going to be.
Okay, and there are proposals to cool the Earth on an emergency basis by injecting sulfate aerosols into the atmosphere on a continuing basis. They call it geoengineering. And one of the key objections raised has been the possibility of unintended consequences, particularly for the cycle of rain and drought. Your research, like the teleconnections map in Figure 2 of the new paper, seems to confirm fears of unintended consequences of geoengineering with sulfates. What are your thoughts, Keita?
I think if we've learned anything through the aerosol research that's happened over the last 10 years, it's that aerosols are an incredibly complex component of the climate system. And as I said, they are not only impacting climate in the place where they're changing. They can also have impacts very far afield. And so given the impact that we have known that these aerosols have had over the industrial era, I think we have a lot of reason to be concerned that we would be able to get exactly the results that we want out of putting these aerosols into the climate system intentionally.
So looking at what we're doing about all this, are there international air pollution conferences as there are for, say, the climate convention?
This is a really important challenge that we have been trying to address in our work in getting the climate community to think more carefully about aerosols. Most of the policy work that's been done around aerosols has happened in the context of air quality and air pollution regulations. So there are large international entities that have focused on sort of transboundary transport of these aerosol pollutants and the ways that that impacts air quality for other places. But those sort of international discussions up until now have not interacted in a very meaningful way with the international bodies that are talking about climate mitigation. And so one of the big goals of the work that we've been doing is to really get out the message that these two communities need to be talking to each other. We are very likely to reduce our aerosol emissions because it's a public health imperative. But if we're not thinking about the impact of those aerosol changes on the trajectory of climate change and climate risk over the next decade and two decades, we're going to be missing a big piece of what is going to be influencing climate risk for specific regions across the world. So that communication needs to be increased.
Geeta, you've worked with some of the top research groups in America. What are you working on now?
So we have lots of exciting things in the pipeline. One of the really important projects that we're working on right now is to really quantify the impact of this uncertainty in what aerosol emissions are going to do over the next 30 years for overall climate uncertainty. And so there's a big international consortium of us who are getting together and running a new set of simulations in the global Earth system models that are used to project what will happen with future climate change. And we're building a new set of simulations that's going to let us think about how this uncertainty in whether aerosol emissions are going to increase or decrease in different places, how that's going to impact climate change and climate risk over the next 30 years. So we're hoping with that work to be able to actually get numbers to put in front of decision makers to say, hey, this is a piece of the uncertainty that you're not thinking about that you should be thinking about.
Is there anything else you would like to tell our listeners?
I think the big takeaway message is that there is more to climate change even than we are already thinking about. And so learn as much as you can, talk about it as much as you can, and hopefully in the end we will be able to leverage all of this incredible scientific knowledge that we've been generating to chart a hopeful path for all of us.
From the University of Texas at Austin, we've been speaking with the climate and atmosphere scientist Geeta Prasad. You can find links to her open access paper on rapidly evolving aerosol emissions in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Geeta, thank you for clearing up the air on these tough questions.
Thank you, Alex. It was my pleasure.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Tens of millions of people have their lives shortened by air pollution every year. But does this study imply that it is too late to clean up the air, that we have added so many warming gases? A pollution cleanup might actually cause several times more dead, plus mass extinctions? Maybe we could have ended breathing toxic air in the 1990s before we doubled the rate of our emissions. But now, can we afford it? Do we need the poisonous air to survive? It's a terrible question. Even if clearing up aerosol pollution only adds, for example, half a degree C of warming, maybe that could be the extra push that triggers tipping points that are unstoppable with horrible consequences. We humans ran a giant experiment with our own air supply, and we found a climate landmine ready to blow us into a hotter world. Greenhouse gases from burning fossil fuels and agriculture are the prime driver of climate change. We're sure of that. But it's not the only one. We can't overestimate aerosol changes as the big factor, but obviously we can't ignore the impacts of aerosol changes either. And so far, That is what the climate community has done.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Let's keep in this theme by revisiting my January 2023 interview, Leon Simons. You may know James Hansen as a leading climate scientist from NASA, the man who warned Congress about global warming in 1988.
Altogether, this evidence represents a very strong case, in my opinion, that the greenhouse effect has been detected and it is changing our climate now.
Hansen is out with a new bombshell paper called Global Warming in the Pipeline. It is not yet peer-reviewed, but it's out there on the net for comment. The paper is huge. Hansen says we have already reached a doubling point of greenhouse gas emissions when we count the other global warming gases like methane, nitrous oxide, and a bunch of halogens. The authors also claim mainstream science has underestimated the power of what will happen now that the Earth is so far out of energy balance. This is disputed by other scientists. Finally, Hansen says, as he has for a decade, that when you add this up, sea level rise will be much higher than we have been told. And that does fit in with our first guest on disappearing glaciers this show. But Hansen and his colleagues think we could get several meters of sea level rise, say 12 feet or more, by the year 2100. That is apocalyptic for most of the world's great cities and agricultural deltas. The Warming in the Pipeline paper is too big for one program. We're going to start with just one of the most concrete and provable instances of hidden warming that is being revealed by a change in the atmosphere. This is the story of how clouds of pollution that cooled the sea and the land are disappearing, letting in the full power of the sun. Our pollution actually helps cool the planet. New science warns, as governments clear the air, as they must to save our health, Earth will experience more warming faster than ever. The paper is called Global Warming in the Pipeline. It comes from a team led by former NASA scientist James Hansen. The paper is still up for peer review, but evidence has been building for years. Among the authors, we can find Leon Simons. Leon is not officially a climate scientist, and yet James Hansen credits Leon's contribution to this paper. Simons nailed a crucial change in ship emissions and cloud formation. Leon is an independent climate policy analyst and a Netherlands board member of the Club of Rome. From the Netherlands, Leon Simons, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, thank you.
Almost everything we buy these days arrives by container ship. The ocean is really busy with transport. How could global shipping modify global heating?
Yeah, so there's two things to consider. Of course, there's the greenhouse gas emissions of global shipping. Many people will know about that. When the ships burn fuel, that's oil from refineries, which is more or less the end product, so the good stuff, let's say, goes to cars and to airplanes. What's left is the more sticky stuff, which needs to be heated to be able to be burned in these chambers. It's more like in between oil and coal, let's say, so it's very thick. And that contains, of course, carbohydrates, and carbohydrates contain the energy. And if these carbohydrates are burned, that releases CO2. So that's what most people will know about energy use, is the CO2 emissions associated with that energy use. But these fuels which are taken from the ground also contain sulfur. Most people know that if a volcano erupts, that a lot of sulfur is emitted into the atmosphere. If you are near a volcano, you will smell the sulfur. Fossil fuels taken from the ground contain sulfur. And the oil that is burned by ships has had, until recently, a very high sulfur content. That was 3.5%. And sulfur, when it's burned, it will go into the atmosphere and it will become very small particles. And these very small particles, they are very light, bright, and they will reflect sunlight. But these particles also act as what is called condensation nuclei, which means that water droplets in the atmosphere, water vapor, will condensate against this particle of sulfur, which makes it create clouds. But these, because these particles are very small, the sulfur particles are very small, very large and bright clouds will be formed. And when this is done over the oceans, the dark ocean will be covered by a large layer of clouds, which reflects sunlight. And with a lot of emissions over the oceans by about 50,000 ships over the past decades, that resulted in a cooling over the oceans. And with the reduction of sulfur fuel content, as litigated by the International Maritime Organization, the concentration of sulfur in the fuel reduced from 3.5% to 0.5%. And that results in a very significant reduction, of course, in emissions over the oceans, which is then resulting in a reduction of cloud formation, which reduces sunlight that is reflected back to space. And then, accordingly, there will be more heat absorbed by the ocean.
The new sulfate emissions from the IMO really went global in 2020. The ships either have to get a cleaner fuel or put scrubbers on their stacks. Is there any way to track whether the rules are working? Has there been an impact already?
What to consider here is that, of course, first the rules have to be enforced. We've seen it in 2015, for example, where there were regional sulfur regulations near the coast of North America and Europe. And there we saw that there was a very strict regulation, and also the ships, they did change their fuels or they did change to scrubbers. And we see the same happening now starting on January 1st, 2020, where leading up to that, ships were already installing these scrubbers or were already buying the low sulfur fuels. Accordingly, we expect, of course, to see changes in how much heat is reflected back to space, how much sunlight is reflected back to space. And now from data from NASA, we can see that there's less sunlight reflected back to space, especially over regions of heavy shipping, which is, for example, between North America and Europe and North America and China. We see a very clear signal that there is less sunlight being reflected back to space, which is in line with the limited modeling studies that have been done, which predicted that, especially in these regions, there will be additional warming from reduction of sulfur emissions from shipping.
But the cooling of pollution is not just coming from ships. A priority for the Chinese government is cleaning up deadly air pollution in most cities, a lot of that coming from coal burning, which also has sulfur in it, as we know. The United States already curbed sulfur emissions in diesel fuel. Did you establish the role of ship pollution relative to other sources of human-made aerosols?
Yes, there's indeed emission reductions from sulfur from in the United States, from cars, and but also especially with the reduction in coal use. When fracking started in the past decades, there was a significant switch to the burning of gas instead of coal, which reduced emissions of sulfur from the United States in about 12 years with 70%. And it was the same happened in China, as you mentioned, where a lot of coal plants either installed these scrubbers where they take sulfur from the emissions, or they close the dirty plants and build new ones, which should have these scrubbers. So indeed, there's a lot of policy happening globally, which is reducing sulfur emissions. But we do see, especially in the regions where the ships sail, we see that especially there is a very significant increase in absorbed solar radiation. And that is a relatively pristine environment, because there's, of course, that there are no other industries, and there's potentially some wind bringing pollution from other regions, but the atmospheric lifetime of these particles is about 10 days. Therefore, you expect the most effect over the oceans and the changes over the oceans coming from ships. Of course, we have still only about 2 years of data, starting in January 1st, 2020, when the most significant change in litigation was coming into effect. It's possible that it's variability or it's a different source, but the signal is really very strong. It's about 3.5 watts per square meter of increased solar radiation happening over the North Pacific, the North Atlantic, and the United States, this area combined, and that's a significant part of the of the globe, and especially by looking at such a large area, that helps to reduce the uncertainty of variability.
That's an immense amount of incoming energy that is now reaching the surface. Suppose reduction in the sulfate emissions on land and sea and what the paper calls the great inadvertent aerosol experiment. How much previously hidden warming will emerge, and how fast?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And yeah, of course, the honest answer is we don't know. We don't know for sure, and that's, of course, many things can happen. If there's tomorrow a very significant volcano emitting a lot of sulfur into the higher atmosphere, into the stratosphere, that could cause cooling, so that could compensate for the warming. And we have never seen such a, if this is indeed causing, for example, a global warming of, let's say, it's called forcing. So if this change causes a forcing increase of the high estimate, which is about 0.5 watts per square meter, that will be equal to 10 years of global greenhouse gas emissions. We've never seen such a significant spike at once of forcing changes, especially because it's a very regional change. So the regional changes might be even more significant. And we already see very significant warming now happening in the areas where these shipping emissions have been reduced, which is the Northern Hemisphere mid-latitudes. For example, here in Europe, we just had record-breaking temperatures. Some winter temperature records were broken by 5 degrees Celsius, which is almost, 8 degrees Fahrenheit, I think. That's very significant, and we've seen more of these significant record temperature changes in the northern mid-latitudes in the past 2 years. And this should really be taken into account when doing the assessments of what causes the warming we see in the past 2 years and most likely also happening in the coming years, because this is something that very little research is done on still, unfortunately. Well, it could be a very significant change. It could cause very significant change to regional climates.
Well, Leon Simons, do you think world leaders are aware cleaning up air pollution could add dangerous heat to the planet?
The ones I've spoken to are not aware of it at all. For example, the IPCC, which is, of course, the advisory body on climate change to policymakers, rarely communicates it. And if they communicate it, it's often in the fine print. And therefore, I think, or that doesn't help to inform both policymakers or media, and media, of course, have a role to play in translating the complex science from the IPCC and other climate research to policymakers and to the broader public. So there's still a lot to be done to better inform both the media and the public, and, of course, policymakers about this subject, especially because it could have significant short-term effects. If you talk about climate change and regional impacts and risks, aerosols changes are likely more important than greenhouse gas changes on the short term.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith from the Netherlands. Our guest is independent climate researcher Leon Simons. He's just co-authored a new paper with James Hansen and other leading scientists.
And I found that there was very little research yet available on the subject. Therefore, I contacted James Hansen on this, and we discussed it. And first, he was a bit skeptical about it because, of course, it's this such a significant change of 80% reduction over the oceans of one of the most important climate forces is something to be skeptical about if that could really happen. But that's what proved to happen because of these the availability of cleaner fuels and the availability of the scrubbers, which are there to take this sulfur from the emissions. And then, yeah, he asked me to work with him on a paper to highlight these findings. And, yeah, that's what we've been working on in the past 2 years.
And isn't it ironic that conspiracy theorists looked for chemtrails out of planes as hidden geoengineering? Meanwhile, we were cooling the planet, but not on purpose, and we were doing geoengineering right out in the open.
You say right out of the open, but I think in a way the oceans are not, for many people, for most people, the oceans are not right out of the open. And that's maybe the reason why they have been forgotten in a way. both by the public and by many climate scientists. While the oceans do absorb 90% of the global warming, 90% of the heating, the additional heat entering the Earth system is absorbed by the oceans, and the oceans have 70% or 71% of the global surface. But still, 100% of the people live on the land surface, of course. So most people are not aware of what's happening with the oceans. And that's, I think, also one of the reasons why many climate scientists have not been aware of the initial cooling effect of ships over the oceans, which is still very uncertain, and the emission reductions and the potential warming effect of these reductions.
And one of the biggest concerns about geoengineering, like injection of sulfates into the upper atmosphere to cool the planet, is what if it stops for any reason, from economic breakdown to war or political change? Now, some people hear the term termination shock and they think of mass extinction. You led a 2021 paper about termination shock. What do you mean by that term?
Termination shock is a term that's often used when talking about geoengineering, where the climate is cooled down by especially putting sulfur into the stratosphere, and then that causes cooling. But if you stop, then the stopping that could result in rapid warming. But termination shock is also the effect of terminating other emissions. If you terminate the emissions of shipping, if you stop emitting particles over the oceans which cool the oceans, then that could have a rapid warming effect. And the shock describes the rapid warming. The rapid warming is described as a minimum of about 0.2 degrees Celsius of warming in 10 years.
That is distributed globally, so it could be a lot more than that when it arrives on land, for example, in a heat wave or something like that.
Yeah, so this 0.2 degrees Celsius of warming in 10 years, that's a minimum to describe it as a termination shock. And we don't know if there will be a termination shock. That depends on the effect which it will have on the climate, which, again, are still uncertain, but the first signs is that the effect might be stronger than most even climate scientists thought. The effect could be about 0.2 degrees Celsius or higher when it turns out to be a termination shock. And indeed, the regional effect will be stronger. So there will be more warming in areas where these emissions have been reduced, because that's also the areas where initially there was cooling. For example, in Europe, in the 1980s, there was a very high amount of sulfur emissions from coal burning. And then for health reasons and to reduce acid rain, there were scrubbers installed at these coal-fired power plants. And then in the past decades, we've seen a very rapid increase in warming. And Europe warmed by about 2 degrees Celsius over the past 40 years. So since 1980 or 1990, Europe warmed by about 2 degrees Celsius, and that increase in the rate of warming was caused by reduced sulfur emissions, which caused less clouds and more sunshine and more warming.
Yes, there's a novel called Termination Shock, and it suggests we would have to cut 20 times more carbon to offset the change in sulfur emissions. What do you think?
In my view, if this reduction in sulfur emissions over the oceans really causes a warming equal to 10 years of greenhouse gas emissions, if you want to reduce that effect by reducing greenhouse gas emissions, you would have to stop emitting any greenhouse gases for 10 years.
Now, as we speak, it turns out Europe is warmer than expected. You mentioned that, and that's a welcome development during the gas shortage scare. But I think the public associates global warming more with hotter summer heat waves. Is it true the biggest warming, at least in these early stages, will be in winter?
I'm not sure. I think that depends a bit on the region. We do see that in the winter, there's more, up to now, more warming, especially over the northern hemisphere. there's different things at play there. Of course, the southern hemisphere receives more radiation in the winter, which is even more than because the Earth is now on the 4th of January, the Earth is closest to the sun it will be all year. And that's when the southern hemisphere is faced towards the sun. And that causes the Earth to receive more heat in winter, which also causes, of course, more heat to be absorbed by the southern hemisphere, which causes more an imbalance between the different hemispheres. And when we reduce emissions, especially in the northern hemisphere, these things might impact the distribution of heat between different hemispheres. So there's many things at play, which are very uncertain still, because, as I mentioned, this is an experiment which has never been done before. So we don't know exactly what will happen. But understanding of these complex systems is crucial, and how these large regions, which are about 50 million square kilometers, what happens if we increase the amount of energy being absorbed there with 4 watts per square meter? Yeah, that's still uncertain, but it could be very significant. And I think some of the very strong heat waves we've been already seeing are a worrying sign for that. And this can happen in winter, but it can also happen in summer.
We can't get into specifics about the new Warming in the Pipeline paper until it is published, but I think this may be the most important science I've seen in the last year or two. Generally, what does the public need to know, Leon?
I think the public needs to be aware of the effect, the reduction in especially sulfur emissions can have on the regional climate. Because they need to be able to prepare for the rapid changes they are being faced with. If it results in temperatures which we have never seen ever in our lifetimes, we should know about that and we should be able to prepare for that, because otherwise we can be faced with the consequences with even more severely than if we were preparing. So I think that's really crucial. We now heading for the iceberg, in a way, blind. Well, we have the binoculars, we have the information is there, we have the knowledge that there is an iceberg approaching, but we should be preparing, we should be getting the lifeboats ready, so to say.
From the Netherlands, we've been speaking with Leon Simons, co-author of the blockbuster new paper Global Warming in the Pipeline. You can find links to his work and the MIR presentation by Leon all in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Leon, thank you for helping us out on Radio EcoShock.
You're welcome. Thank you for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
Covering the world, this is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Leon Simons is the independent climate analyst based in the Netherlands. He is co-author of the new paper Global Warming in the Pipeline. James Hansen credits Leon Simons for the work on ship pollution and climate change. We will cover more of this paper in coming shows. Leon Simons says clouds forming from ship emissions were hugely reduced almost as soon as new regulations drastically cut sulfur. That lets in more sunlight to hit the ocean and warming the seas. Now, with all the satellite eyes in the sky, this should be easy to check. So I did. In a press release dated October 28, 2022, NASA did indeed find, quote, a global standard limiting sulfur in ship fuel reduced artificial ship track clouds to record lows in 2020. Drawing on nearly 2 decades of satellite imagery, researchers found that the number of ship tracks fell significantly after a new fuel regulation went into effect, a global standard implemented in 2020 by the International Maritime Organization, the IMO, required an 86% reduction in fuel sulfur content, likely reduced ship track formation. COVID-19-related trade disruptions also played a small role in the reduction. That's an end quote from NASA in the fall of 2022, and it pretty well backs up what Leon Simons has told us. The hard data is in a paper published July 2022 in the journal Science. The title is Global Reduction in Ship Tracks from Sulfur Regulations for Shipping Fuel. Now we get into a weird bend in all this science, as geoengineering may have diminishing returns. So, the paper that we just quoted also said, the global 2020 fuel standard is likely a watershed moment that will permanently reduce the population of detectable ship tracks. They go on, such studies will also help assess the effectiveness and impact of deliberate marine cloud brightening as a geoengineering option, end quote. But there lies a problem for artificial solutions like cloud seeding. A paper published October 3, 2022, was led by Duncan Watson Paris, and it was in PNAS. And it says, while locally the relative sensitivity of ship track formation to emission changes can be seen as large as 1.0, there is a large spatial variability, and the global change in the number of tracks is clearly sublinear. An 80% reduction in SO2 emissions causes only a 25% reduction in number of tracks detected. Since the change in droplet number is known to respond logarithmically with increased condensation nuclei, this demonstrates how far from their pre-industrial conditions the shipping corridors are, even after such a large reduction in emissions. It also highlights the difficulty faced by proposed marine cloud brightening efforts due to the diminishing returns on injected aerosol, end quote. Now, I know that was complicated, but I'm sure you got the basic ideas there. This is a new objection to marine cloud brightening to save us from our own emissions hell. It sounds like we would have to pump more and more particles into the stratosphere just to keep the same effect. Or maybe it weakens until it doesn't work. Nobody knows. But like most things in science, some object to the cooling claimed by Leon Simons. A study led by Franziska Glasmeier in Science 2021 found, quote, studies of stratocumulus cloud tracks that are formed by ship exhaust have been used to estimate the radiative impact of this process. But Glasmeier et al. Now show that this approach overestimates the cooling effect of aerosol addition by up to 200%, end quote. So it's all a study that is still very much in action, as Leon told us. Ship track clouds have been looked at since the first satellites were launched in the early 1980s, but the operations of clouds are still, well, cloudy. We learn new things about them all the time. A study published last October in Nature found, quote, only a small fraction of the clouds polluted by shipping shows ship tracks, end quote. So there's a lot of pollution from ships that doesn't form those wispy clouds and cannot be seen by satellites. And even the unseen particles from ships can cause cooling. Our guest Leon Simons knows all this and warned us there's still a lot of uncertainty about how clouds work and how much cooling they may give us in the future. Remember our 2019 interview with NASA's Tapio Schneider? They found a ceiling of greenhouse gases, possibly starting around 1,200 parts per million, where the massive low clouds famous in the tropics could no longer form. That would be a big loss of cloud cooling, another wave of imminent warming on this planet. But we're only about halfway to that 1,200 parts per million deadline. Who knew we were cloud makers? Why did the chemtrails people point to clouds from aircraft emissions when ships and coal-burning power plants were really the ones cooling the planet? Their emissions do poison us, while millions are dying prematurely every year from air pollution. And we talked about geoengineering as a future thing while this civilization has been doing it for decades. Right now, as Leon Simons told us, we are finding out what happens when you rapidly remove polluting but cooling particles from the Earth's atmosphere. We are getting a small dose of termination shock. That replay interview from Radio EcoShock in January of this year completes our special program on aerosols and climate change. It is just a huge subject. Breaking Science shows even microparticles of plastic in the air. That's a Japanese study. Check out my EcoShock show November 9th, 2022, called Your Body is Partly Plastic, So is Everything Else. Are you ready for plastic rain? You can find further notes, ideas, and pointers to more Breaking Science on aerosols in my show blog at ecoshock.org. That's ecoshock.org. I'm Alex Smith. Tune in again next week. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.